Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. Here with me in studio today is Meredith Barnes-Cook, who is a technology and operations transformation leader in the insurance industry. Meredith, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I appreciate you for coming back to the old stomping grounds in Needham to join us today.
My hometown.
So tell me, way back in your hometown or that era, what got you excited about technology?
I was always the person, even when I started running an employment program in college, I was always process-oriented, trying to problem-solve and make things as efficient as possible. And so when I went into my first job as a claims adjuster, I found I was staying late after hours, observing the workflow around a very manual world in those days, and just working on streamlining and then collaborating with different departments to say, let's figure if we can take hours and days out of trying to get work done.
Were you a classically trained operations management, Toyota, lean person, or is this just something that came natural?
I think it's my DNA. I think it's organic. It's just how I'm wired. I think what others saw in me, I evolved from a traditional management role in an organization that was going through tremendous change and coming in and evolving organizations and creating new ones. And then it really evolved to explicitly them offering a position for me to become an operations manager, first at the New England level, then nationwide, working through a tremendous amount of organizational and process and structural change.
So at an insurer, what are they constantly battling? Is it trying to get new subscribers? Is it keeping underwriting correct? Is it managing claims?
Their challenge is twofold. One is keeping the existing customers that they love and are profitable happy as their needs are evolving. But on the flip side, it's almost this bipolar experience where they also need to be thinking, okay, what else do we need to be in terms of products and services that we offer to compete for the next generation of businesses that are emerging and growing?
So you worked with change leadership, stumbled sideways in a technology role. What was that like moving into tech?
Again, it just felt really natural. Tech was emerging within the company of moving away from mainframe and building our own solutions. And I was originally what we'd now call the senior product owner. I was their expert on what did the claims organization need for the future and why, as I was a key part of understanding that, not just the what, but the why. And I was up spending all this time with the development teams. And it was literally, they pulled me aside one day and said, why don't you just stay and run some of it? And it was literally the shift. I said, okay.
Oh, so you were up in the Great White North for a while?
Well, I mean, Seacoast.
Okay, not too bad. We spoke on the pre-call about career management versus career ownership.
Yeah, career management, I think, has this strict interpretation to me that you have a defined destination that's never changing and you're laser focused on it. And I think it's good to know at this moment in time what your next interest and aspirations could be. But what I discovered again from my own career, which really became what somebody called a career jungle gym, as opposed to a ladder or even a path, is there's so many new opportunities around, new things emerging, things you wouldn't have thought of that be on your path. And I always say, keep your peripheral vision open at all times to see that thing that didn't exist a year, 2 years ago that actually could be your next amazing move.
Yeah, I think that we still have some things that are entrenched, like declaring a major in college or career direction that people feel obligated to go towards. But I see how hard it is, especially now. My oldest daughter is thinking about college and like, what would I major in? And I've looked back and I was like, business and operations management, no foreign language requirement because I'm terrible at them. Sounds good.
And I went to school to grow up and become a self-confident, self-aware person. I was a psychology major. I didn't expect to be going into psychology. It was just something that really interested me. And I went to a tremendous all-women's college at the time. It was all-women's Wheaton College in Norton, Mass. And that, for me, was my 4 years of going from what I was to what I was intended to be and getting great business experience during all of my breaks. And I actually started in the insurance industry literally right around the corner from this office at an insurance agency. And that's when I discovered, believe it or not, insurance is quite fascinating and it's customer service oriented.
So what was the name of that agency?
Barry and Farrell Insurance, and it's still there.
Okay. How did things start there? What was it like walking in and becoming a part of an agency?
It was great because it was small, family owned, Jack Farrell, and then Ed Barry, who at one point, I think, played for the Bruins, I believe, way back in the day. in a very small organization. And so I got a chance to do everything from new business applications, processing payments, handling claims, which is where I discovered being a claims adjuster was interesting, and then doing the runs to the registry to register all the customers' new cars. Mm-hmm. And so I really got a chance to put my hand in all of it, and just in a very small operation, that was a good way to immerse.
Yeah, a lot of people just either pay their premiums, or actually if things go well for the insurance company, that's all they do.
Exactly.
Yeah, we occasionally have a claim. We had an auto claim recently. We had a homeowner's claim. And I could see that it's a tricky dance for the claims adjuster to try to give you what you're entitled to and what's reasonable versus what you may want, and kind of talking you into that. How does that whole thing work?
It is tough, as you've discovered, of being a customer. And I think what the pandemic has really revealed is it's still too complicated. It's still too tough, especially with businesses and the business interruption insurance and all of that. The language needs to be simplified. The content needs to be distilled down so people know what they are covered for, and honestly, more importantly, what they aren't covered for. I've had so many consulting calls where there's this belief that somehow it was withheld about pandemics being excluded and those types of things. And I said, respectfully, I challenge you to go home and pull out your homeowner's policy and your auto insurance policy and find the exclusion section and call me back and tell me you weren't surprised. Because the things that aren't covered are the things that will rarely, if ever, happen. So you don't think about, am I covered for a pandemic? We will all think about that now, but it wasn't something, especially in the United States, that was even a possibility. Just back in 2001, we didn't think about terrorist attacks either.
Yeah, I remember we got our insurance policies early on in the business, and they're like, okay, you need general liability. Then we started getting some bigger customers, and they said, you actually need E&O. And I'm like, I thought that was for realtors. And they're like, well, it turns out it's for you too. It's for if you have any errors or omissions, and you need to carry at least this much per incident and this much overall. And more of our contracts started requiring that. And E&O is quite expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Then they started carving certain pieces out, like, hey, would you also like terrorist protection? Because that's no longer covered. We now do that a la carte. And then they started doing that with cyber attacks and many other pieces. And yeah, a lot of folks are figuring out that business continuity does not include a pandemic.
Right. And now even some of those things like cyber, for example, or even terrorism are now morphing from not just being a business concern. They're a personal risk as well. And sometimes at a personal level, you have far less resources to bounce back from something like that.
Yeah. So personal, the one I noticed from owning an apartment building once upon a time is the wind allowance now, especially if you live down near the coast. They'll say that the first 10 grand of anything that happens because of wind is on you. And then we'll start picking things up after that.
Yeah. And that's the tailoring. And that's one of the upsides of all the data that's now available. The insurance industry isn't like any other. We're able to mine that data to start looking for the true drivers of cost. And do they need to, with regulatory approval, because it's highly regulated by each state, get permission to curtail some things? Because the flip side is, if it wasn't defined that way, you probably wouldn't like the price tag of your insurance, because that's the trade-off.
So talk to me a bit about getting work done through people instead of in spite of them.
It's one of my favorite catch lines, that and hashtag every conversation makes me smarter, which is my learning of networking. I think in this world of technology, people miss the point that be it Tesla or be it your phone or what we're doing here, it all evolves through the hard work of people. And especially more than ever, you can't lose sight of getting to the heads and the hearts of the people that you need to make things happen, including automation. And understanding that as we introduce more and more automation, more and more change, people's roles change, and you still need them, but you need them in a different way.
Yeah, one thing I've noticed is I watched it on my daughter's sports teams, and then I thought more and more about it at work and how much it applies. You've got to connect with your teammates. You've got to like one another. You've got to kind of have this shared purpose and goal. Like, I watch when the kids that aren't willing to sell out for one another, that aren't willing to go that extra mile, to do that extra thing. And if you don't build that in business, you get kind of mediocre or not great results. You don't think about how much that matters. Like, is it something as little as having the kitchen and doing like meals that you can earn together, or things that you can share and goals that you can reach and little rewards and stuff. But it really does add up to how much are you willing to do for one another that may or may not be part of your job description.
Absolutely. And even as a big a company as I was part of, spending 33 years at Liberty Mutual, it would be just interesting how I would be on a project team with some people in the telecoms groups, and we were doing the original voicemail rollout, and how many more times a lot of those people, we were back together working on something else again. Something completely different and unrelated. They'd move to a new part of the company. I'd move to another. And just having those relationships, we also came together with trust, which lets you get to that place where you're more comfortable paying it forward and not just paying it back.
So to make a call back to Sarah Morgan's episode, she talks about the speed of trust and where if you have trust, it's an asset. And if you don't, it's a liability. It's like a tax on how quickly you can move. You trust each other, you can kind of have a shared, unspoken, okay, I know this is going to get done. Whereas if you don't, it's like, well, is this person really going to get this done? Are they going to do a decent job? So forth.
Yeah. And I like you mentioned before about relationships. I mean, that's a big part of it. How you gain trust in part for me is my getting a read on the individual. And how do I get a read on the individual? I spend time with them. I interact with them. And so I know how to interpret their tone of voice. I know their voice inflections and their body language and, you know, what might sound now this challenge, everybody pivoting to remote, might sound like resistance to someone who doesn't know that particular person. I know, oh no, that's just how they sound. They're totally all in. That's just their tone of voice.
Now, is there a big difference in your opinion between a mutual insurance company versus a strictly for-profit? And well, actually, I guess tell the listeners, what is the difference and maybe talk about why you liked Liberty?
I loved Liberty and still do. It's, you know, in my blood forever because it was always about people. And I remember going to a manager meeting and the president at that time came in and said, why is integrity part of our code? And, you know, we're like, well, because it's the right thing to do. And he said, no. We don't compete on price, we compete on service. We are looking to create long-term relationships with customers. If you don't have integrity, that won't happen. You have to be what you want your customers to purchase, and it has to be totally internalized. And Liberty absolutely walks that walk without question. And the mutual company, it's actually a mutual holding company, which is something they pivoted to about 20 years ago, which gave them the option to own publicly held organizations, but still be owned by their policyholders. And I think a lot of that gave us our leadership, very courageous leaders through my tenure at the company who didn't shy away from doing the tough things and making the tough calls for the long-term good of the organization and therefore the policyholders, is you have that latitude because you don't have the traditional shareholders to go back and kind of fight through. You're accountable to your mutual, your policyholders, absolutely. But I think it's a different relationship.
So you said around 20 years ago, they were allowed to purchase other companies. What was it like in the acquisition phase and folding in these acquisitions?
Well, there was one acquisition, which was Wausau Insurance. And initially, they brought them in to stand alone on their own brand. So they were there and they were agent facing. Before then, Liberty Mutual had been exclusively direct writing. And so they knew getting into the agent writing segment was a key part of their growth strategy. And a great way to do that is buy a known brand, you know, WAUSAU, USA in the middle, and all those various commercials they used to have. So they bought them, but they kept them as a separate entity initially. Then the world changed and they had bought quite a few others. They bought Peerless, they bought Golden Eagle, they bought a whole bunch of regional players that sold through agents because that's what the industry wanted. I don't want to buy from Big Liberty Mutual. I want to buy from Indiana Insurance. About 10 so years later, customer interests and desires pivoted and they said, I want to buy from Liberty Mutual. And of course, we're like, well, you are. And they're like, no, I want to buy from Liberty Mutual on the not letterhead at the top, not at the bottom. And so what they then decided what they wanted to do was absorb all of those, with the exception of Safeco, which they've left as a standalone on the personal line side. They absorbed all the rest of them under the Liberty Mutual brand. And so all of a sudden you had 8 or 9 individual companies that have been running top to bottom as their own companies, literally their own P&Ls, et cetera, that suddenly got thrown into the mix with these pre-existing Liberty Mutual entities. And I had a department that all of a sudden doubled overnight, and here they all come, and they're all looking around. And when I was announced as the leader of the group, it was interesting. The people on the West Coast, predominantly the Safeco is where they were located, supporting all the agent companies, they thought they were all getting fired and replaced by people in New Hampshire because of where I was located. And my team in New Hampshire, et cetera, thought that they were all getting relocated to Seattle. I was like, where did you get that just from my name being announced as leading this larger organization? They filled in the blanks pretty nicely. And so it was a lot of time spent getting to know all these people and as fast as possible, them getting to know each other to say, nobody has an edge here. And that was a big challenge for me to be sure that I made extreme effort to create presence with people who did not know me before and being out on the road continuously and regularly from that point forward to create relationships that they could learn to trust and know that there wasn't an underlying agenda on my part.
To find my next job, first, I want to hear about dozens of jobs I am overqualified for.
Someday, I will talk to a recruiter who knows the difference between Java and JavaScript. That will be the one.
Would I mind commuting 3 hours each way each day? Of course not.
All I have to do is go through 5 separate interviews, complete a 10-hour coding exercise, and recite the national anthem backwards? I'm in.
Finding your next consulting gig should not be this difficult. Quite frankly, you deserve better. Syrinx is the consulting company founded and run by software consultants. We get you. Find out why our employees are some of the happiest and best paid consultants in the industry at syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com. Find a better way today. Syrinx Consulting is a proud sponsor of Underserve, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry.
Now, I've seen somewhere before, I think 50 or 75% of acquisitions do not yield what they hoped for, either from bottom line results or merging of the two cultures. I imagine these are former competitors you're folding in. What's it like to try and get them to march to the Liberty Mutual drum?
Very challenging. But we want to hear your voice and we want to hear your perspective and having to make very overt steps to be sure that that's actually true, that they really do feel heard. And so what I found really worked for me was I would create cross-legacy organizational working teams to say, okay, what's our collective we? How are we going to do that work going forward? Because you all have different bits, parts, and pieces of what is our combined best practice. And so I want you all to go together and work this through and come out with our combined solution going forward. So even if the end product didn't look significantly different from how maybe we originally were getting work done, I wanted to be sure we were explicitly taking that time to kind of refresh and overhaul and redocument everything that we were doing to make it the collective ours.
All right. Can you tell me a bit about your experience doing agile transformation and how that's kind of a full circle journey?
Yeah. One of the many great opportunities that Liberty gave me was to actually work on their first digital customer capability. And this is back in the days when Netscape Navigator was the predominant browser. Yes, yes, I know. We all chuckle. And I had a half sheet of paper, sponsorship from the president of the company of, we need to do something with customers on the internet. Good luck. And this was spun up in the fall, outside of the budget cycle, et cetera. And so we really just said, okay, we need to get really close to some customers really, really fast to figure out what do they think? What do they want to do? Have they even thought about this? And we need to grab a really small number of people that we had to poach from other teams to create a really small group with technically no budget. My boss used to remind me every day, you know, you're a variance, right? Every day that you show up, I'm like, oh, that's really helpful. He was busting my chops. So we really figured out what we were going to do and how we were going to do it in an extremely practical, logical, highly collaborative, minimal documentation. It's all about the result. It's all about the customer feedback. We were working in the customer's office most of the time down in Fall River, Mass, our MVP account. And literally developers would be there with us, with my analyst, and we'd be sitting there. We'd get a screen up and test, and we'd have the customer log into it and just tell us what you think. Does this make sense? Is this what you would expect? Is it too much? Is it not enough? And we built it out that way. So when we flash forward several decades later into the agile transformation and I start digging into what is that? And I went, oh, okay. I recognize the mindset. That's what the aha was. Forget all the labels and the branding and all the official language of it all. I recognize the mindset, the intent, and what's great about it. So when I announced to my whole department that we were doing this, and of course, change, you get the deer in the headlights look. And I went around the room and said, okay, who worked on this initiative? Who worked on this project? And we were just doing it the way that made sense quite a long time ago. This is going to feel very familiar. I said, remember how much fun it was that you really couldn't distinguish what role people were officially in the organization, who was the analyst, who was the developer, who was the technologist, who was staff, who was a contractor. You really couldn't recognize that. We got together every day. We did a recap of what did we get accomplished? What did we need to do? Who had time and knew how to go after it? Divide and conquer. Come back tomorrow. What did we do? I said, remember how fun that was? That's where we're going back to. It's just now more defined. It's going to be more formal and official, but we're going back to that fun way of getting things done, getting back to that mindset of shortest way to get between two points is a straight line. And over time, as we got bigger and bigger and bigger, we started introducing all these hurdles. So everything was up, over, and down, up, over, and down to get things done. And we're going to start getting those hurdles back out of our way.
If you had only copyrighted, patented, and trademarked Scrum, Agile,
no, Sprint, darn it. I'd be retired now.
One of my eye-openers with the insurance industry was learning what subrogation is, and I actually had to experience it personally recently. So if John hits Joe with his car and Joe's insurance company pays Joe to get his car back on the road, they then go after John's insurance company in order to recover the money that was put out there. So that whole process is called subrogation, and one of our clients actually sat in the middle of this. They were like the intermediary between the two insurance companies.
Okay, yep.
And they're having to answer the phone and like get faxes back and forth about, did you get an appraisal yet? Is this a total loss or are we going to try and fix it? And, you know, do you have like two estimates and yada, yada, yada. And they're spending all this time basically intermediating. So we came in and developed a portal so that the two insurance companies could then self-serve and basically provide the information to one another and decide like, all right, do you want to admit that your guy's at fault and we're good here and you're going to cover everything, including the rental? Or maybe, you know, do we need to fight this out more? We were able to free up a ton of folks that were formerly basically just being middlemen between these two insurance companies. Did you ever have to deal with subrogation at all?
Oh, absolutely. I'm having flashbacks of back in my claims handling, claims management days. It was a multi-carbon form you filled out, and then you kept your copy, you mailed it in, then they wrote their feedback on what they thought or didn't think, and then mailed it back to you. And it was just this paper going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And there actually really was by design no actually even phone interaction. You fought the whole thing through on paper. This one document bouncing back and forth through an intermediary organization. It was crazy. And at the end of the day, the companies you've introduced in that self-service enables the companies that financially they were forecasting, they were getting money back to get it back as fast as they can. And the company that anticipated, yeah, our guy rear-ended the other one, we're going to pay on this one, getting their payment out, because late payments are almost as bad as late revenue. Because based on how you're setting aside your expense forecasts, when you don't pay out what you thought you did, now you have to re-reserve that for next year. And it turns out you didn't spend it last year, and that's not good financially either.
So what have you done differently now that we've been thrust into this world of COVID-19 and pandemic? What have you discovered or rediscovered as part of that?
I've spent a lot more time meeting new people. And people might raise an eyebrow, but virtually. I think people feel now that they've been working at home, they have a bit more time because they're not traveling. They don't have the commutes anymore. And I've spent so much more time reaching out to people as well as connecting people. That's really become something I've become very passionate with. And again, I always say hashtag every conversation makes me smarter. I've just met so many wonderful people. And I wish I'd been charting it because I would see what my graph would look like of the past 6 months, proportionally the uptick of new people that I've had the opportunity to meet.
And I think you lived in South Africa once upon a time. What was that like?
I did. Moved there when I was 10 years old during apartheid. So obviously a very disturbing environment in all ways that matter. But it was fascinating culturally because even in an apartheid environment, I was in a school system that was, their public schools look like our private schools, school uniforms. You call the teacher sir and ma'am, very much on academic achievement and all of those things. The teacher walks in, you stand up and greet them, the level of respect that they instilled. And culturally, I was in a school system, even with the segregation, that were 39 different nationalities. And these weren't, including people born in South Africa, but people literally born all over the world. And in fact, one of my dearest friends from when I was a child there actually now lives in California. She's now a U.S. citizen, and we get to see each other periodically. But it was really a fascinating time.
Could you tell me a bit about your experience with your track team in high school and how that was different than your average sport?
Yeah. Needham High School. Rah, rah, rah.
Go Rockets.
Yeah, go Rockets. Shirley Singleton was the coach, and then Peter Judge was the assistant coach. They were what we would say is completely inclusive. If you want to be on the team, you're on the team. That's it. There's no tryouts. There's no nothing. And then you find whatever events you want to be in. It doesn't matter if you're great, average, or terrible. If you want to run the relay, you run the relay. You want to throw discus, that was my event, you throw discus. And so what we wound up having is a huge team. And so we'd be at meets against one other high school, and it would be running a relay race, and we would have like five teams running up against their one, which needs to say was quite intimidating to the other team. Like, who are all these people? Oh, that's just us. Everybody was welcomed, which was tremendous. We usually needed multiple buses to get there. But we were also, during my time I was in high school, we were undefeated. We were Bay State champions all 3 years that I was there. And I think in large part because of the sheer power of the strength that we had in numbers.
Yeah, there's a lot of specialization that happens now. You know, if you play club soccer or club lacrosse or club hockey, A, that's probably keeping you out of your school sports a lot of the time. But B, it just kind of narrows down what you're doing 10 or even 12 months a year, and it's not casting a hugely wide net. Whereas, yeah, it's almost Darwinian. We're going to put everyone in here and someone's going to do well.
And that's it. We had quite a few state and national level people. And I think it was because it was such an inclusive environment. It also was very competitive, but it was very welcoming. And it was just a really, really great community for 3 years to be part of.
Now, what did your coaches end up doing after that?
Shirley went on to found Edgewater Technologies. I was at some technology event, and all of a sudden, her name pops up, or she was showcased at their booth. And I was like, no, that can't be the same person. And after I recognized her, I knew it was. And then Peter Judge, for a while, ran the MEMA, the Massachusetts Emergency Management Association. I think he must have retired recently. So I would see him whenever we'd have a hurricane or a blizzard coming through there. He'd be on Channel 5 being interviewed for the latest forecast.
So another thing we talked about on the pre-call was Tesla. I've been doing my best salesman routine to get you and folks in your family interested. So how's that going?
It has been so exciting to watch. It's our son, who's a software engineering major at Rochester Institute of Technology, and has been a fan of electronic vehicles, both on the technology marvel behind them and the enhanced autopilot, but also because of the post-manufacturing environmental footprint, because he's also very environmentally minded. And he spent much of his summer while he was on his home-based co-op at Citrix. He, thanks to Turo, he was able to rent several of them and did a few test drives. He actually has been put on the list at one of the dealerships that he can't do any more test drives because they think he's done too many of them. He probably drove 1,000 miles in Teslas this summer. And I often would go with him. It's great when he says, I'll rent a Tesla and then I'll drive down to the Cape to see my father, his grandfather. I'm like, great. I'm all for not driving. But fascinating to be on Route 128 in very, very busy, almost not quite rush hour traffic. And he's got the enhanced autopilot running and he's letting the car keep him in the lane, control the speed. And I'm just like, I think I'm going to take a nap. I can't watch this anymore.
Sometimes it's hard to let go. You're used to driving. You're used to being in control. But that in particular, I think, is where autopilot excels. Best use case I've seen is stuck in traffic, put it in the middle lane, tell it, don't change lanes, just keep creeping me along. And then I'll keep a hand on the wheel. I'll pay attention, but I don't stress out about it. I'm not worried. Someone cuts me off. This happens, whatever. You're like, it'll handle it. I'll get there eventually.
And that's what he said. He said it's physically, it's so much less taxing on him. So that's why he's willing to make the long rides in him because his way, it's not physically exerting for me. And I'm like, okay, a little stressful for me, but all right.
So you mentioned Turo. I will definitely give them the underserved, undeserved endorsement. I use them as well. When I was considering buying a Tesla, I'm like, well, how's this going to work? Like, can I open those doors in my garage? What's it like to charge somewhere? What's it like to use a supercharger? How would this work? Turo allows folks, kind of like Airbnb is to houses or apartments, Turo is to cars. Folks can put their cars on there for rent and you can sign up. And I picked one up kind of near Logan Airport one day, drove it for the weekend, tried out all my use cases and also tried to see if I could get rid of my range anxiety. You know, do I ever have enough juice in it? And actually that pushed me to buy the 100-kilowatt Tesla because I wanted the most range where I would never worry about like, oh, am I getting down too low? Where am I going to charge? So yeah, Turo, T-U-R-O. Is the website. And if you have a car, you can actually put it up for rent. Maybe you live somewhere near an airport or train station or whatever. They'll even see exotics on there once in a while, like Ferraris and Lamborghinis. So definitely neat if you like Airbnb or want to try out a car. Or if a car rental place is full, you might be able to find a Turo rental available as well.
Yeah, because my son, his plan was originally he was going to buy his first Tesla after he graduated in 2022, which has now pivoted to when he gets home in November of this year. And so I asked him, I said, but if Elon announces something earth-shattering that'll be available come next year, are you going to wait? And he's like, no, there's always something better.
So here's the thing about Elon. He's amazing, produces amazing things, but they're not always on time, on the timeline. Yep. So if you like what's out there now and you think it's reasonably priced, then I would say go for it. You know, there's always going to be something bigger and better. But yeah, if you like it now, now's the time. Now, your son started out, I think you mentioned he got interested in software and so forth way back building Legos back in the day and then moved on from there.
Yeah, he did some type of self-assessment in elementary school. He came home one day all proudly and said, I'm a visual spatial learner. But he fell in love with the Legos at a very young age. And being an only child, we were more than happy to over-appease him in that regard. And our whole house was filled with Legos. Every room of every house had every Lego kit. And he very quickly pivoted from buying the kits to then taking kits and merging, combining, and designing his own things, his own planes, his own trains, his own buildings. And he started doing that. And then for a while, Lego had a virtual community where you could build online. It was called Lego Universe. And for a while, and he'll kill me for saying this, but his original on-screen thing was from Lego Universe. That was what he originally used. But when that went out of business, the company got sold and then delicensed, he moved over into Roblox. I think first Minecraft and then to Roblox, which is international, and it's what they call user-developed content. It's a really fascinating business model that exists because all of their players build all the games that all the people pay to play. And so he got involved in that probably, I think he was 13 or 14, and he became one of their lead developers. And through that, learned so much about the fundamentals of great design, of great software design, of the criticality of testing, the opportunity to automate. He learned a lot. He had a role that they recently moved back to employees that he did as a volunteer for a while. He was monitoring all the incoming tickets coming in from users and having to vet them in terms of change requests versus defects and criticality and severity and all those things. And so he learned a lot about the basics of software development and support through that platform.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that through gaming development and gaming platforms, he got kind of a peek at the corporate world.
Yeah, because he got very close to the Roblox organization itself and how they ran. He was probably 15 when he knew he was going to be a software engineer. He was the exception to the norm of young people knowing what they want to study in school. And so he did his first co-op at a company called FIS, subsidiary WorldPay, that runs the intermediary layer between credit card companies and retailers and banks and all of that. And he's actually in the process of submitting a patent for a problem that he solved for them there. And it was that fresh set of eyes looking at something they were extremely accustomed to that they just, well, that's just what we do. And he looked at it in the wise old age of 19 at the time and said, that's crazy. And asked his boss for permission to work on it because he had an idea of how this might be solved. And he was right.
The patent process is interesting. I've been through it myself and I know some people that have patents and either are using them to build something or are enforcing them for people that are violating them. And it's a whole subset world of technology that most people don't consider until it's kind of thrust upon them.
And the nice thing is RIT will actually shepherd it through for him. So he contacted the people at FIS, talked to them and got their full blessing to go ahead and submit it. Because I said, don't wait. If you don't, they might. They might be similarly impressed with what you came up with here. And so he redacted the appropriate things. And so the school, they'll actually shepherd it through the process.
Does the school own the patent after that? Or how does that work?
Strictly his.
Oh.
Yep.
Nice.
Strictly his. He will, in his senior year, his full senior year, they do what's called the senior project. And quite a few of those turn into co-owned patents. Big posters all over various buildings on the campus. So if he comes up something amazing, that would absolutely, because it was done with their sponsorship and guidance.
So Meredith, thank you very much for braving it and coming in to meet us in person to appear on Underserved.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure.
And we'll talk to everyone real soon on the next episode of Underserved.